I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Baltimore-based tech entrepreneur Greg Cangelosi likes to sport a baseball cap bearing the words, "Never Stop." That's his motto, and he certainly lives to it as a tech visionary, CEO, and investor in startups. He joins us for the second hour of the show today to talk about his ventures and others emerging in Baltimore's growing tech scene. Up front, someone finally has a plan for the old McCormick Spice site on Light Street near the Inner Harbor. It's a 40-story-plus apartment building, the preferred home of millennials and empty nesters who seem inclined to rent rather than own. Kevin Litton of the Baltimore Business Journal and Baltimore architect Klaus Philipson join us after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here on WYPR. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Is downtown Baltimore the key to a growing population in the city? Right now, there are 4,000 apartments scheduled to be built within 1 mile of downtown. Another 1,400 could be added when State Center is complete. Once more, it's believed that these new units will bring new retail outlets and restaurants to the area, making it even more vital in downtown Baltimore. Today on the show, we'll be looking at all of this planned construction and what it means for the city's future. It's thought that millennials and baby boomer empty nesters are behind this recent flurry of development. We'll examine some of the reasons behind this increase in the demand for urban apartment living and whatever happened to condominiums. Today on the show, Kevin Litton is with us, reporter for the Baltimore Business Journal, who over time has become a frequent midday guest because he produces so much. And there's actually a lot going on in the city, and Kevin covers commercial real estate development for the BBJ. We like getting him on the show. He's back again today for the full hour. Nice to see you, Kevin.
Great to be back. Thanks.
And also joining us today, another midday contributor, Klaus Philipson, president of the local architectural firm ArcPlan Incorporated. Klaus also serves as co-chair of the American Institute of Architecture's Urban Design Committee, and he contributes to the Baltimore Business Journal, writes about architecture and planning for the BBJ. Nice to see you again, Klaus.
Thanks for having me back.
Kevin, I want to start with 414 Light Street. Did I get the address correct?
You got it.
Yeah, this is a famous address. Baltimoreans will remember it because of its smell. Once upon a time, this was the McCormick Spice Building. It's been a parking lot, it seems like forever, but since the late 1980s sometime. So it's been sitting there vacant, uses the parking lot all this time near the Inner Harbor. What's up with that? Let's start with that story.
Well, it's always been seen as one of the most attractive parcels, but for some reason, there just hasn't been anything that's happened on that lot. So it's a surface lot now. It's one of two surface lots in downtown that city planners have been really frustrated with because surface lot is not the best use of space right there on the water, and it's not the best use of tax revenue. So the last thing that happened with it that was really big was that there was going to be like this huge 60-story tower. It was going to be offices. It was going to be this very ambitious plan, a new tallest building in the city. And then the recession hit, and the company that wanted to do the project went into bankruptcy, and a judge ordered the property to be sold. So it was purchased in 2011 by a local firm known as Questar Properties, Inc. So they've had the property for 2 years and have been working on a proposal which is about to go to the city's architecture review panel for its first meeting this afternoon. And they're planning a 40 to 45-story apartment tower. They haven't said how many units, but my guess is well over 400. They're going to do first-floor retail. And they're also going to do it as a phased project. So first they're going to do the apartment tower, which will be waterfront, offer sweeping waterfront views of the Inner Harbor. And then behind it, they're going to do another structure, but they're not sure what it's going to be used for. Could be office down the road. Our office vacancy, it does not really create the office demand that they would want to build an office tower now, but it could in a few years.
Wow. 40 plus stories at the inner Harbor on the old McCormick Spice lot. I mentioned at the beginning of the show a number that we got from you, actually, Kevin, about 4,000 apartments in the pipeline within a mile of downtown. Just sort of scope out the general picture for us there. Where you are with the demand for apartments versus condominiums. I mean, 5 to 10 years ago, we were talking about condominiums in Baltimore.
Yeah, the Downtown Partnership of Baltimore a couple years ago put out a study that they said that we could absorb as many as 5,800 units within a mile of downtown. So that was really at the front end of the boom. And when that study came out, I think it's helped spur some confidence among developers who are already seeing a really low vacancy rate in the existing apartment buildings. So Southern Management, which is a huge apartment developer in the both the Baltimore and the Washington region, had done the BG&E Tower. You know, that was one of the big residential conversions down there. Mm-hmm. The Muncie had been done, which is an old office tower. And those buildings were filling up at like 95, 96% rate. So there was really very strong indication that if you built more, then they were going to lease up pretty quickly. And we've already started to see that happen. As these projects got underway and started coming online, we had 400 units deliver last year. One of the biggest ones was Union Wharf, which is down in Fells Point, which
all
was
apartments.
Brand new construction.
All apartments.
And just really fantastic amenities. I mean, this is on the scale of a luxury hotel. These are the kind of amenities that Union Wharf offers. That leasing went extremely well. Really impressive, actually. And then there's some other apartments that have been coming online that are also leasing up at a really good pace. So as these apartment projects start to deliver, I think what everybody's going to be looking at is how fast do they lease up. And mm-hmm. there's a big question about when you have that many units, I mean, it's a tremendous amount of new residential space that's going to come online. Is that going to lease up at the pace that you're seeing with Union Wharf and some of the previous projects?
And another question I have, and Klaus may want to address this for us here, is the idea of renting versus owning. That's why I brought up the condominiums. Kevin, last time you were here, you said that you know there's almost no market for condominiums right now.
Yeah, there's none in the development pipeline at all. I mean, Silo Point was really the last big condominium project. They still have some vacancy over there. To be honest, it's really not even that easy to get a mortgage on a condominium because condominiums are seen as really risky to banks.
So, Klaus, what do you think is going on here? What is driving a rental market versus an ownership market?
Well, that's interesting because I worked when I came to town in 87. The first project was a condominium project, the Canton Cove condominiums.
Oh, yeah.
And at that time, the general idea was that Baltimore is not a condominium town. And then a crisis hit then also. And Henderson Wharf and several others went in bankruptcy.
I remember this.
But Canton Cove did not. Then the condo market recovered, and Silo Point is an example where it was pushed pretty far upwards with the sales prices, and then we tanked again. I think that's partly a sign of a somewhat recovering market that we don't have as much condominium, but partly it's also the trend of the millennial generation that the media write a lot about and talk a lot about, where it has to still totally substantiate itself, but that the new generation, younger people, don't really care to own all that much, that they are into share and more ephemeral possessions, and that bike sharing and car sharing and renting is all in. I mean, partly it, of course, has to do with that we have to recover from having had one of the highest home ownership rates in the country, I mean in the world. The United States had one of the highest with nearly 70% home ownership. And we pushed homes into the hands of many folks that would have been better off not to own. And so we are still in the recovery from that. But I wanted to say something about McCormick because you have this picture of the Old Spice Company.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned it. On our Facebook page is a picture of the old McCormick Spice Company. If you never saw it or if you forgot what it looked like.
It is a case of where we were too demolition happy. So this is 30 years ago that we demolished this. And, man, would we be happy if we could do this as adaptive reuse today.
You're not kidding.
Because that's exactly what the people are dying to get. Is these old industrial buildings that have flexibility in the floor plates to allow conversion. And that's what we're doing with the building also on Light Street, the Bank of America building, and a lot of other places. And that gives us the edge as Baltimore over, say, Austin or Denver, who have to fake a new kind of loft buildings that they built from scratch when we had them. And so there are several buildings around the Inner Harbor that we demolished and where there was no real plan in place. We have since, as the AIA pushed very hard, the American Institute of Architects, my committee, that the city would adopt rules that you have to have financing and everything in place before you can demolish anything. But, of course, it is never guaranteed.
So the attitude was that was industrial Baltimore, and the industrial is one thing, residential another, commercial another's all seen as separate. This idea of reuse, it just wasn't here at the time, was it? I mean, we were renovating houses in Baltimore in the 70s and 80s. That's when that started. But we did tear down a lot of these old industrial buildings.
I mean, yeah, as Canton Cove shows and Tindeco, we started to reuse old industrial buildings. And actually, Baltimore is probably nationwide a leader in having innovative and creative examples of adaptive reuse. And Silo Point is one of the most interesting ones.
But it has happened. I guess I'm incorrect, because around the Inner Harbor, you look at the power plant, that was reused. That wasn't torn down. But over in this side of the town here, with the key highway where the shipyard was, there weren't a lot of buildings.
No, I was alluding to News American site,
the News
example,
American site,
which is still empty.
And Kevin, that's you alluded to the other surface. What did you call it?
Surface parking.
Surface parking. There's a parking lot there where the News American building used to be. Some people listening to our show today probably didn't even know that there was another newspaper once upon a time published down there. Can I ask you this question about a 40-plus story apartment building at that site on Light Street? Is that going to run into any opposition? Are there people who say we shouldn't be running building skyscrapers, basically, blocking the view of the harbor for others? This has come up before a little further down on Key Highway.
Yeah,
what about
I talked to a couple of neighborhood groups about it, and what they both told me was that anybody that's bought a home since the McCormick site was torn down, always expected a tower to go up in its place. So there's not really a lot of opposition to, say, the neighbors in Federal Hill raised when the Ritz-Carlton was first proposed. So, and looking back on what happened with the Ritz-Carlton buildings that were built there, I think is largely seen as a mistake now, because there was so much opposition to the height of the buildings. The only way to make the project work from a financial perspective was to build it out, so build it horizontally. Mm-hmm. So what that ended up doing is when you drive down Key Highway towards Locust Point and you look to your left, you've got this gigantic street wall, almost a monolithic street wall, that really blocks even more of the harbor from the street level. If you had been able to go vertical in the way that Harbor View had gone, you would have had, you know, several buildings that offered some of those sight lines down to the harbor. So I think in that sense, this is really seen as maybe we can learn from our mistakes there, allow this to go high. I don't think there's going to be a lot of opposition to it.
Okay, let me ask you this question, and also for Klaus. The suggestion is that this is luxury living. People hear waterfront, high-rise, something new, they assume it's going to be expensive and not priced for the average person. A Facebook comment from Angela, who says there's absolutely no need for more luxury housing in Baltimore. We have widespread blight and vacancy, and a dire need for low-income, affordable housing. All this, and she's talking about the proposal that we're discussing here, the high-rise apartment building on the old McCormick site. All this is going to be is an eyesore for me. My guess is it will sit largely vacant for quite a while the condos blocking Federal Hills, like the condos blocking Federal Hills views. The city needs to invest in affordable housing to stabilize the existing communities of Baltimore, not build towers of luxurious housing to lure high-income renters from outside the city who won't stay anyway. That's a pretty cynical view. And by the way, the city's not building this. This is a private developer. Klaus, comments.
This is a debate we have had for as long as I set foot into this town, which I think is a false dichotomy. It's both. I mean, sure, we do need to do the neighborhoods. Absolutely. There are very interesting affordable housing projects. I'm going to write for the BBJ about the Lillian Jones apartments on Greenmount Avenue, and I'm going to talk about the M building on Howard Street. There's the Gateway housing on North Avenue. All these are attractive and higher-end affordable housing, not high-end in the price, but in the design. So it's not like there is nobody paying any attention to rebuilding neighborhoods. But at the same time, a city has to be nimble and has to be open to change and to ignore the trend of young people to come back into the cities and be urban and not build for them, and also the trend of having expensive stuff in downtown rather than out in the burbs. If we did ignore that, we would forego a huge development opportunity that fuels the tax base and can help also finance the neighborhoods if the city wouldn't give up all the taxes that they get from these new developments. That's another discussion.
News and commentary about development in Baltimore, commercial and residential. Reporting for us today, Kevin Litton of the Baltimore Business Journal and Klaus Philipson with his commentary, Baltimore architect Klaus Philipson. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. The email address for Midday, midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. You know, I'm mulling that over, what Klaus Philipson was talking about in the first segment of the hour about reuse. There's plenty of reuse, examples of reuse around Baltimore. The McCormick Spice Building is not one of them because it became a parking lot. But for the record, Klaus, the other vacant lot or parking lot that we referred to was the News American Building, which is right there across from Harbor Place. It's been sitting there as a parking lot since 1980, whenever they tore that down. I think late 80s, maybe early 90s. So was that a loss, that building, though? Oh, you think so? The News American Building.
There were several buildings that were very, I mean, some predate my time, and I know only from pictures what was there. But yeah. Generally, the greenest thing to do is to give a building new life. In a new use, and oftentimes the buildings have details and have architecture, have materials, have crafts that you can't replicate these days anymore. So there is currently an initiative between the National Historic Trust and the Urban Land Institute for five cities in the United States, and Baltimore is one of them, to show the benefits of adaptive reuse with the goal to prevent more demolition in cities and have instead reuse.
And Kevin Litton of the Baltimore Business Journal, you had a cover story, a couple months ago, less than that, about the reuse of some neat old buildings in Baltimore for residential purposes, for housing.
Yes, and it really, Klaus made a great point about how this really gives Baltimore an edge in what it offers in its rental housing stock, because if you look at our closest neighbor, and sometimes people see as our biggest competitor in Washington, D.C., they've only had one adaptive reuse project in all of the 23,000 some units that they've delivered or that are in the pipeline. So I think Baltimore is really unique in having those properties to offer, and I think that's what people are seeking out, is this historic, authentic sense of lifestyle.
Well, speaking of authenticity, Klaus, I wanted to hear from you a little bit more about millennials. I think this is really interesting because it appears that what's driving the rental market in downtown are millennials and baby boomer empty nesters, people who don't want to fuss with a house anymore and like the idea of apartment living. But I'm particularly interested in your views of the general outlook you see emerging among the millennial generation.
Well, I'm thinking that there might be a trend from quantity to quality, so that folks are not so much interested in the 6,000 square foot home in Honeygo or somewhere out in the boonies, and that they rather go smaller and have a higher quality and less transportation. And that was also the point that Charles Montgomery did in his book that we recently discussed here about the happy cities, that the folks that commute the most are the unhappiest. And so this trend from quantity to quality, I like to observe in a lot of circumstances. It happens in food. Instead of, an all-you-can-eat buffet, we are eating now from farm to table. And instead of having tons of cheap coffee, we drink quality espresso, or it goes in many respects. And I do have this kind of science project at home with my six children. They are millennials, and what are they doing and where are they going? And two of them bought houses, but they are both in cities, right in the city, and they're very small, but they are lovely. And the quality over quantity came to bear there, and others are renting. And so I can observe this, and they all picked places that have a high quality of life. And so I believe that the competitive edge that we have in Baltimore and that cities in general have is quality of life. People care about what it looks like, what it feels like, what the atmosphere is, what access to recreation, entertainment, education you have. And they are not caring anymore about just having a monoculture.
And this comes down to also choices not only about where you live, but what you do for a living. Choices when it comes to careers and jobs. What kind of research do we see on millennials, Kevin?
One of the really interesting things, I think, about the millennials that's come out is how many fewer people that are 19 years old have driver's licenses. When you look back 20 years to or 30 years to 1983, 87% of people that were 19 years old had driver's licenses. Today, that's fallen to 69.5%. And a full quarter of those people said they'd rather bike, and 17% said that they want to take public transportation instead. So why is that? I think, as Klaus said, they don't see a commute as having a great quality of life. They'd rather live close to where they could work, and they want to be part of the action. But I think there's also another sense that a really interesting theory that I heard from somebody who just bought a hotel, the Lord Baltimore Hotel, downtown Baltimore. She was at an event the other day, and she said that she thinks that young people see the big cities like Baltimore as the new frontier. You know, years ago, the West was seen as this big, wide-open frontier with these endless possibilities. But millennials tend to want to have some kind of social impact, and they want to be careful about how we treat the environment and all of these things. And I think when you look at what you could do this in the city, she argues that the city offers this new frontier where you can have this great social impact, where there are things that are being done in cities that are more exciting than anywhere else. And if we can bring cities like Baltimore back to life, then you're a millennial, you get to be part of that. So I think that's part of what's really going on. I do have my own theory about why young people love mass transit so much. And my theory is that if you think about what millennials really love the most, they love their smartphones, right? So my theory is they don't want to get in the car because they want to spend as much time as possible on their smartphone, and they can do that while they're riding the train. They never even have to look up.
Well, and unlike my generation, who kind of tried to change the world on a big scale and always thought global, and then got frustrated when that went too slow. The young generation that I see is interested in sort of direct action. So we have this phenomenon of tactical urbanism to come into vacant sites and have pop-up retail or have pop-up events or just put empty crates and build something out of them, have a stage, do music. And actions really have immediate results. Also, cities are great places for innovation because it's so much easier to implement something in a city, even if it's a relatively large city like Baltimore, than it is in a nation state. We can see in D.C. that they have really a hard time getting anything done. They neutralize themselves. I mean, D.C., the federal government. So there is this theory that we live in the age of cities, that cities are globally competing with each other instead of nation states, and that the importance of nation states has gone down. And so the city is the place where it happens and where you can have accountability, predictability. You know, you can see it the next day or the next week.
Kevin Litton, I want to ask you about units in the pipeline. Doug Gansler, the Attorney General of Maryland, candidate for governor here, was on the show last week. And we were talking about Baltimore and what he wants to do as governor for Baltimore in terms of economic development. And he mentioned all the cranes that he sees in the District of Columbia in the nation's capital compared to Baltimore. He says, you know, they're all over the city. I think he may have even thrown out a number about the number of cranes up in D.C. versus what we see here. So even though there's like 4,000 units in the pipeline and more in the planning stage, what's the outlook in Baltimore in terms of new development, new residential units, I mean, besides this 4,000 number? I think it's an unfair comparison with D.C., is this about as good as it's going to get now, or what do you think? I mean, is there room for even more growth?
I would say get ready for the cranes because they're coming. I mean, yeah. There are five development sites that are probably going to get underway in the next year and a half that are close to downtown. David S. Brown has an apartment complex at the former mechanic site. They've got another 30-some-story tower over on the west side. We already talked about 414 Light Street. Behind that, the University of Maryland Specialty Hospital should be getting under construction, plus 300 East Pratt. So that's a tremendous amount of construction that we're going to see. I think
all for apartments and retail?
It's mostly apartments. There's going to be a little bit of office space in the David Brown project.
Could you just talk about that for a moment? That's at the site of the Mechanic Theater. Right.
The site of the Mechanic Theater is going to be all residential with retail on the first floor. That one is going to be, I believe, 32 stories, and they're going to demolish the Mechanic Theater, put in the apartments. And I think the biggest key in that project, which a lot of people are really hopeful for, is getting it underway so that we have a large block of retail space downtown. That's a big issue. We have much higher vacancy in downtown Baltimore for retail than we do in the region and nationally. So we're a little behind the ball on that. But one of the problems is that you've got these big retailers who are now exploring urban models, but they can't find the space to do it in downtown Baltimore. That building would offer enough space to bring in a Target or a Walmart type retailer. And it's really going to be needed, I think, by the time it gets underway, because when you add all these residential units, you need home goods, you need groceries, you need those types of things.
But I thought we don't have it in downtown. Retailers were going small in urban areas, including Walmart.
They are. Walmart has gone smaller. They've done multi-story Walmarts in some cities. We have not seen that yet in Baltimore. But we don't really have anything above 15,000 square feet. And even the smaller urban models need more than that. I mean, one of the struggles that's been going on lately is trying to find a new grocery store to replace the Fresh and Green, which was right up on Charles Street. Mm-hmm. A lot of people missed that. It did a tremendous amount of sales per square foot, much more than
that
even...
was right at Charles in Saratoga, or Charles in whatever that is.
Sales per square feet, they did better than the Harris Teeter down in Locust Point, but it's hard to find a grocery store that can take that small of a space. So the retail tends to follow rooftop. So we're going to see the retail come in. The question is, where are they going to go?
Well, retail also needs some real leadership. Retailers are risk-averse. Very risk-averse. They like their models that they have tested a million times. So they went from, you know, the mall to the power centers to the lifestyle centers all on the Green Meadow, where it's pretty easy and predictable. And in cities, it's a lot harder. So where there is a vibrant city, there are coming, but sometimes you have to manage that. And Harbor East is an example of retail that we received in Baltimore after the developers really managed what they wanted there. And you have to manage retail like in a mall. You know, you have to have a clear idea of what you want and where and how you locate it, and then really trying to attract it. And I know that our city leaders go to Las Vegas to those conferences and so on, and they're making the attempts in that direction. But I think it needs to be much more focused. And so, for example, for the West Side, I believe that the West Side cannot become like this retail core for the city that it used to be, but it can be a place where you would have a lot of the smaller local retail that has a comeback nationally, and some of those smaller configurations that national chains bring. And if we make a targeted effort, we can do that. Of course, it helps if you put a lot of more apartments into the place first. And there is this question, of course, always looming, where are these people going to come from? And are we going to not overbuild like crazy? And I just wanted to speak to this for a second, because I saw that one of your callers has that question also. The region is supposed to grow by 250,000 people by 2030. If we would just attract 10% of that growth, which is a very, very modest thing, then we would, you know, get 20,000 or so people into Baltimore, and then we need 8,000 or so units in the entire city. So that's as long as the region is growing. Then the other thing, you mentioned Washington, this is another one of those false dichotomies. Because we can only look at Washington as an entity that is at the hip with Baltimore. Baltimore is joined to the hip of Washington. So this is one metropolitan region that grows together. And without Washington, we wouldn't be what we are. And we need to capitalize on this much more. And transportation
you
is
think,
the piece.
You think that's true? You think without Washington, we wouldn't be what we are, Baltimore?
Right. We wouldn't be, because we are developing in tandem. And the shift from the industrial city that we used to be on our own account to a knowledge community, to a knowledge-based, innovation-based city is only possible with the demographic hinterland that we have, thanks to Washington and all the government jobs that we have. So, no, I think without D.C., we wouldn't be what we are.
Let's take some phone calls, 410-662-8780. Klaus Philipson with us in the studio, along with Kevin Litton from the Baltimore Business Journal. Claire in Baltimore, thank you for calling Midday. Go right ahead with your question.
Just an aside, this isn't my question, but what Klaus was saying about D.C., I saw a discussion online about what's the hippest neighborhood in D.C., and the answer was Baltimore. So,
thank you.
I have a question about, you're talking about all this creative reuse that's going on downtown, but there's still these huge swaths of vacant buildings, and one in particular that's caught my eye, I've watched it like this, you know, kind of fall apart over the years, is bounded by Calvert Street, Lombard, and Water Street, and it's got some really interesting buildings. One's really tall and narrow. One looks like about early 19th century kind of house kind of building. And it's all like right all in the middle of that kind of business district there. And I was wondering if you guys knew anything about that.
I'm trying to picture that. Kevin, you want to take that?
I believe she's referring to what was originally going to be a big hotel project that was going to be done by developer Mark Saperstein. He had an exclusive agreement with the city. It's a city-owned property. I have good news for you. PMI has just come in, bought the building, and they're going to do 180 units there.
Okay. In Calvert, bordered by Calvert, Lombard, and Water Street, huh?
Yeah, Water Street's sort of on the back end of the project, I think, is what she's referring to.
It's an assembly of buildings, and there was originally a lot of demolition, and I think the new proposals have more adaptive reuse and some demolition.
They're going to be reusing that tall building that the caller's referring to, and they're going to be demolishing some of the smaller ones.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here for Midday. If you'd like to get in on our conversation about development in Baltimore, about the city's population growing and who's going to be renting and who isn't, 410-662-8780. When we get back, Kevin Litton from the Baltimore Business Journal has some more projects to tell us about, and we'll have more commentary from architect Klaus Philipson. You're welcome to join us. That's our phone number, our email address, midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday. Kevin Litton from the Baltimore Business Journal. Kevin covers commercial real estate development for the BBJ. Klaus Philipson, Baltimore architect with Arc Plan in Baltimore, also contributes to the BBJ, commentary about architecture and planning. And we're talking in this hour about development in and around Baltimore, mostly in Baltimore. And Kevin, there were some other projects I just wanted to get some quick notes from you on. Canton Crossing, Harris Teeter has finally opened down there. Is that right?
It was a mob scene on Tuesday for the grand opening.
Were they giving away free bananas? Or what was going on?
They had 15 different tasting tables. I mean, people were just so excited to have an alternative to the Safeway that's been there for the last 15 years.
Right.
And I think to have it right next to a Target, next to a Michaels, you know, in this development that's very much like you would see in the suburbs, people are just really excited about it. And there's a lot of pent-up demand for retail on that side of the city. I mean, when Target and the DSW over there opened, they had the best opening weeks of any other of their chains in the rest of the country. So you can just imagine.
Maybe retailers start to believe in cities again, or believe in Baltimore anyway.
Well, they certainly do that anyway. And there in Baltimore, it's really a strange story because we do have a lot of pent-up demand, not only on the east side, also on the west side. We are under-retailed, totally. You know, there is really no downtown shopping to speak of, except now in Harbor East and the Gallery Place. And there is no real good reason for that, because other cities have, like Pittsburgh has a downtown Old Navy and whatnot. Then there are really still some stores and department stores in some cities that are smaller than us. So we need to catch up on this, and we need to convince the retailers to do that, because the demand is there. But we are too timid in setting our eyes low, kind of. Canton Crossing is an example. So we think, it's good that this service is there and that the people now have this retail, but it is not good that it took this suburban form that it took, because the story is, well, we couldn't convince these retailers to do anything more urban, they wouldn't have come. And it might be true. But the fact is, they are doing so good now, or so well, that why couldn't they spend a little more money in making much more attractive stores and a more urban solution than a suburban one?
Well, here's an interesting example, though. The Petco company, which is noted for pretty big box suburban stores selling pet supplies, right? They want to plant a store in Fells Point. And that'd be a pretty tight fit wherever you are in Fells Point. What's the idea there, Kevin? What's proposed?
Well, Petco's store is called Unleashed. It's an urban concept that sort of makes the concept a little bit smaller than what you normally see. And they're going to be one of the first tenants in the marketplace at Fells Point, which was a full redevelopment of some really aged and derelict buildings that were on the 600 block of South Broadway, right next to the North Shed of the market. The developer did something really interesting there, which you haven't really seen. They left the facade of the buildings. That was the only thing they left. And then they gutted the rest of the thing, excavated the whole site.
It was one of the most amazing things I've seen. It looked like a Hollywood set for a little while with just the fronts, the facades of buildings. But they've pulled it off. Klaus, have you been down there to see this?
Yeah, I toured it yesterday with the Urban Land Institute.
Tell us about it, would you please?
And the east side is pretty much complete, and they can put tenants in and fill the retail and have tenants. And the west side is a little behind, but they are then following suit with that. So this is overall, I think, 157 apartments. And they are high-end. They are pushing the same $3 a foot a month price level that is pretty was unheard of in Baltimore until Union Wharf and some projects on Light Street went in that direction too. It will be interesting to see whether they can feel this. There are fantastic views from there. And, you know, from a preservation point of view, this was, of course, not real preservation, and it was before this was a local CHAP district that the project got grandfathered in this manner. But I think it is very successful in the sense that along Broadway you keep totally the impression of the historic Broadway, and then behind it you kind of stack up the new volumes that are needed for contemporary living.
Will shopping improve in the markets there?
The North Market is part of their project. They have deferred completion of that, is my understanding, because of the Red Line coming through and the station being built right in front of that. And so that might be a field office for the Red Line for some time.
Kevin, also, the Gunther at Brewer's Hill, what's going on there? It's the old Gunther Brewery, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's really like in the top three of all the residential conversions that we've seen, like in the last year, because it was a former beer brewing facility that closed in the 1970s. Hardly anybody I talked to even remembers Gunther Beer because it's been gone so long. But what they did was, to qualify for the historic tax credits, you have to keep some of the elements of the building intact. So, for instance, they had these incredibly tall four-story beer tanks where they brewed the beer. And they've kept many of those. So you walk through your hall, you see these old beer tanks that are all painted orange there now. They put like this gigantic old Gunther beer can that rises up in the lobby. It's got all of the luxury amenities that you would expect in a project like this. And about half of the units, or more than half of the units, are in the historic building. They did a little bit of new construction just to fill it out. But, I mean, you walk into these apartments, you've got these huge ceilings, you've got these weird, like, slanted ceilings that who knows what they were used for, all the exposed brick. I mean, I took some people there a couple weekends ago, and they were just blown away by what an awesome historic feel that this building has. Another really interesting one, I think, is Mill Number 1, which is near Hamden.
Yeah, this gets us away from Fells Point in downtown. This is out here near the Jones Falls. This is David Tafaro's development, right?
Yeah, that's right. David Tafaro did this development. It's really remarkable for its location. When you walk out onto the terrace that they've built there as part of the mill complex, you're just right there in the Jones Falls. It's, you know, it's waterfront without being Inner Harbor. It's fascinating.
Falls, right,
right. Yeah. And I mean, but this building dates to the 1850s. It's got this really incredible old stonework. I mean, you just feel like you're in a place that is not even really Baltimore. I mean,
What about the highway, though? What about Interstate 83? I mean, it's right next to it, right?
Well, it is buffered somewhat with woods, and it is really amazing when you walk across the bridge from one building part to the other over the river. you feel like you are out in the wilderness. And this
even with the highway there.
The highway is enough away that you don't see it. Of course, you would hear it if you open your window, but it is amazing, a little jewel there. And you know, the Gunther building, I just wanted to say that I toured that like 12 years ago or so with developers to see what could be done. It is, was incredibly difficult to do this because of so many idiosyncrasies in the building that were special to a brewery. It didn't have a lot of windows or any of that. So it didn't have what made it easy to convert it. And so it takes these high rents to get the money recovered that it costs to convert it. And that's one of the reasons why we do need some of these high-end developments so that we can do interesting stuff there. Because you can't do it without either subsidies or with high rents to make it possible.
Let's take another phone call. Marie in Charles Village, you're on Midday Next. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Go right ahead, Marie.
Yeah, I had a question. With all the retail coming in, you've mentioned Canton Crossing, about parking. The parking, yeah, especially down there, they did it so it's like creative, but it's a pain in the butt to get around and trying to find the parking spot in the smaller stores. So in the city, when you're putting in retail, how are you figuring out ample parking?
Okay. Thanks, Marie. This question always comes. It came up the last time we were talking about redevelopment in the city, especially talking about Fells Point, Harbor East, parking, people want to drive. Our discussion about millennials, maybe they don't want to drive so much, or if they drive, they want a smaller car.
It is the irony that when you are making the development like Canton Crossing, which is totally sort of oriented on the car as the solution, you put a sea of parking in front, and then you landscape it, and then you create some of these pedestrian walkways and so on so that you satisfy the new demands for a nicer development, then at the end, it's still an inconvenience. So we have to just kind of give up on driving right in front of stores in an urban setting. And, you know, Harbor East does have structured garages that are tucked away. And New York has a lot of retail where you don't have any parking, of course. And so we need to get to different solutions, because every time we are trying to solve it towards the car, we create more congestion and more hassle than if we didn't even try. You know, all the downtown garages that we have built just lead to congestion when you, after ball game or so, you can see this. You need police officers at the gates of these garages when everybody wants to come out. Those are not the solutions for our cities.
Here's an email from Henry in Fells Point. He's got an important question about something we were just discussing here. He says, I noticed that millennials were spoken highly of as one of the driving factors in the coming apartment boom in Baltimore. I wanted to know if your guests had any idea what kind of pricing we should honestly expect from these coming projects. I went to look at one of the new places that has begun to rent out in Fells Point. It's across from Killer Trash on Broadway, so it's probably this development we were just talking about. They have an income requirement, lowest being about $68,000 a year. I know a lot of my peers, myself included, don't make anything near that amount. What are they doing to market to educated, hardworking millennials who just don't make the type of money these developers are requiring? $1,600 for a studio apartment plus utilities, ? That's a lot for a millennial. This is part of the reason a lot of millennials are looking to forego cars. They can't afford both. Kevin, a comment on that, and then we'll go to Klaus.
Well, I think one of the things that Live Baltimore is doing, which is the nonprofit that tries to promote housing, is they're trying to get start these events where people can actually meet other millennials can meet other people that want to live in the city. And what they're trying to do for that is to try to help people find roommates. So it becomes much more affordable when it becomes a two-person, a three-person household. $1,600 a month, I don't think is too hard to swing for a couple. I think when he raises that $66,000 number, certainly that is high for a millennial, but it's not high when you combine two incomes. Also, the median income for the region is $88,000. So these do fit into that. And, you know, I got to tell you, if you're coming from New York or D.C. and you look at those prices, it looks pretty darn affordable, because you're going to pay a lot more in New York. I had talked to some folks that sold their house in in the New York area, and they moved down here and they moved into Union Wharf, and they're commuting to Washington, D.C. They're both in the finance business, and they absolutely love it. They can't believe the prices they're getting, and they can't believe the value that they're getting in Baltimore. So Baltimore still does offer a tremendous value when you compare it to D.C. and New York.
Still, I do agree with the listener that we do have to look at affordability, and we are running as a country nationwide into an affordability crisis with stagnant incomes, increasing poverty, particularly in cities, and an ever-increasing cost for housing. We do need to solve this, and, you know, the public housing has pretty much disappeared. The vouchers are and the subsidies for housing are not enough. They are decreasing also. And so we do run into this crisis, and we have to address it because Baltimore does have a lot of cheap housing, but what we need is good, affordable housing. And therefore, for that, we don't have enough.
I'm certainly sympathetic to the listener because, you know, these apartments are out of my price range, too. But I still live in the city. I live in older housing stock. And I think when you look around at the housing stock that is available at rental or at, from an ownership standpoint, it's still really, really affordable. I mean, you may not get the amenities, but you can still live in the convenience and in these great neighborhoods.
Well, back to the question of overbuilding. I mean, I assume these developers, these builders would not be doing this if they didn't expect the market to support it, right?
That's correct, and I think the vacancy rate is really what's driving it. Looking ahead, what we really need to look at is there going to be enough job creation in this region to support the apartments, and that's what's really key. There's been some promising job numbers for the Baltimore region recently. Between February 2013 and February 2014, there were over 12,000 jobs that were added to the region, which was really strong. It was stronger than most of the state. If you drill down into those numbers, 70% of those jobs were office-related jobs. They would demand office, so they're professional and business services. So these are the types of jobs that would want to be closer to a downtown area. So in that sense, I think we're moving in the right direction on jobs. And then we could also look to D.C. and what D.C.'s doing with their apartment boom. They are about to deliver 23,000 units in the pipeline compared to our 4,000. So you are starting to see signs of overbuilding. What I would look for is what's happening in D.C. is they're offering these concessions where they'll offer you 2-3 free months free to just try to get you in the door. We're not seeing those kind of concessions in Baltimore yet.
We also need to put this in perspective because the majority of the development is still in the suburbs. And Chris Leineberger, the developer turned advocate for cities, is walking around the country saying we have built for way too long too much of the wrong stuff in the wrong places. And so what we are doing with the urban development is just a drop on the stone, on a hot stone, a drop in the bucket. It's really not that much when you compare it with the overall total development that's occurring in the country. And we are still a growing country and we are a growing region.
Email from Annie Milley, who's the marketing director at Live Baltimore. Kevin just mentioned Live Baltimore. She says, this Saturday, Live Baltimore is hosting Buying Into Baltimore, an event that takes prospective residents on tours of city neighborhoods and homes for sale. The event also makes participants eligible for $5,000 in down payment assistance toward their home purchase from the city of Baltimore. We have more than 400 participants already registered and expect many more to register on the site, so you can get some information about this at livebaltimore.com. We thank Annie for mentioning that. It's good for the context of this show today. Kevin, anything else we want to mention here? Union Wharf, quickly, what's happening there? This is a Bizzuto development. Are we out of time? Oh, I'm sorry. We have about a minute left for you. So this is the lightning round with Kevin Litton. Union Wharf, Bizzuto development down there. Moving along?
Union Wharf is complete. It's pretty much all leased up. The big thing that we're going to see going in there is the addition of a restaurant, Fork and Wrench, which is down in Canton. Already has signed a lease there. I think the big one, though, that we did not talk about is State Center is seen as...
I just mentioned it in passing at the beginning here. We had a big court decision on that a few weeks ago.
Yes, the Court of Appeals overturned an earlier decision that blocked the development. That development's going to get underway, and I think a lot of developers see that project more than any other as having huge potential to transform both downtown and the west side.
Kevin Litton covers real estate development in Baltimore for the Baltimore Business Journal. You can find him online. Find links to his stories on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Klaus Philipson is president of ArcPlan Incorporated and co-chair of the American Institute of Architecture's Urban Design Committee right here in Baltimore. Thank you, Klaus, for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you, Kevin.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And please enjoy lunch brought to us today by The Veranda, located in Hamden on 36th Street, serving home-style Indian food. We thank The Veranda for providing lunch for our guests every Thursday. Please stay tuned for the news, folks, and then we'll see you for the second hour of Midday.